There are certain times in your life when it's easier to reflect on what's transpiring than others, and one of those times is happening in my own life. As Robert mentioned, I'm having surgery next week, and I'm really looking forward to it. When you've been in pain for a while and you have the prospect of getting better, it's something to really look forward to. So I really am. But it's just one of those times when you are able to assess your own frailty and mortality, and you sort of take stock of things. And you combine that with Thanksgiving, which is also a typical time for reflection, and it should be one where you can actually assess and consider and ponder. And the third thing is something that my colleagues at work really have not let me forget. I'm the oldest in my where I work, and I'll be turning 50 next month, and they have gently, very gently reminded me of that over the last few weeks and months. And I'm sure as it gets closer, there really won't be much more note of it than there already has been. But certainly that is a time in which you recognize that you've made choices in your life that have affected you and that probably will affect you in the future. At 50 years old, it's not that you can't start new things or you can't have new careers or endeavors, but you've typically made certain choices that have set you in a certain direction. And as you approach that time, it's a natural time to look at those choices and think about them and analyze them, which is always a good thing to do. Without going into great details, I just want to tell you a little bit about me for a couple of minutes so you know who it is that's talking to you. I grew up in West Hartford, Connecticut, which is a suburb like many other suburbs, I imagine, a pretty affluent suburb and one in which it was a predominantly Jewish town, especially the section of West Hartford that I grew up in. It was really one in which being Jewish and being part of the Jewish community was normative. It was just the way that we looked at life. I remember pretty much developing a we-they attitude, really seeing those who weren't Jewish as them, and just really seeing life through Jewish eyes. Not so much religiously. While my family was attending a conservative synagogue, we were not religiously observant. And yet, culturally, ethnically, we were Jewishness pervaded our entire lives. And as I say, being in a town where it was just pervasive, it was just the way that we looked at life, the way that we were, the way that we saw things. I even look back now and I see the difference of the years that even knowing my grandmother, whose accent was heavy, and it was so obvious that my roots weren't so far from Eastern Europe and from the Jewish life of the shtetl. And I really had that strong connection because when she was alive, I knew her and was influenced by her. And even in the home, my parents were fluent in Yiddish, and they often used expressions just to, and they would always try to translate them in English and always would say, well, it just doesn't work. You're just going to have to figure them out this way. The richness of the language just can't quite be translated. And I think about people like a Hebrew teacher by the name of Pinchas Bernecker. He was a teacher that the kind of guy that you just loved. He had a zest for life, and there was a story that he would tell that as I've been thinking about tonight over the last few days, has really, I've realized that it has actually influenced me and in my growing up and in who I am today. He would tell of a story that when he was a boy in Cuba, never really knew there was much of a Jewish community in Havana, but he would tell us about it, and we learned about it. And he would say that when his mother would put him to bed at night, his mother would cover him with the covers, and He would tell us that as soon as she left the room, he would gently move the covers down just below his ear, because he was taught that when the Messiah came and he was expecting his coming, he did not want to miss it. It was just something that he had learned of, was taught of, and did not want to miss it. And that helped me, even young at that time, to realize that there was this messianic hope in our people. Because as time has gone by, the messianic hope has been less and less. In other words, if you went to a synagogue, let's say in 1940 or 1920 or at earlier times, there was more and more of a talk of a coming Messiah. But we know that it has become depersonalized. Often Messiah is talked of in terms of Israel, or the hope of a personal Messiah has not been kept alive as much as it was generations ago. So it was good for me to see really where our people were and what their yearnings were. I had some special things growing up, like a bar mitzvah with my cousin, which was a great event, and it allowed relatives from California to be able to come. We were born 3 months apart, so they didn't have to come twice in a row. And it was a very special time, and as I've been thinking, it was just one of those events that really set apart my time of growing up in West Hartford. As I've looked back on those years, I've realized that there was a time when I started assessing what is important in my life. I started looking at the situation that I loved my family, I enjoyed my school, friends, but I had a sense that there was more to life than just career and friends and relatives. I just sensed that there was. And I embarked on a trek to find out whether or not there was something more. The trek took me through many unique and different disciplines. Some you've heard of, some you probably haven't. Things like transcendental meditation, yoga, silver mind control, Rosicrucians. I probably could think of more. But they were all disciplines that were trying to look at something more, that sensed that there was a realm of life that was more than just day-to-day existence. I'm going to tell you of an example of something that really taught me that there was another realm. It's pretty strange and it's different, but I know that it's part of my search and part of what propelled me to seek the truth. How many people have heard of Silva Mind Control? Anybody heard of that? Okay, Robert has. This was a course that was popular in the 70s, and it purported to teach someone how to develop psychic powers. Well, that's the kind of thing I was into at that time. I wanted to just do that. Well, my father and I took that course together. We really were in this search together. And as part of the course, there's a certain time where you're initiated, and you meet this guide who will help you perform these psychic experiments. When I say meet, I mean in your mind. I know this is bizarre, but I've got to tell it. I was really struggling whether to do it or not, but it's part of who I am, so I'm going to. I met this guide. You go to your level. You're taught to go to this level, as it's called. You meditate. You go to this certain state. And I met my guide. Now, my guide, I could picture her. She had shoulder-length hair. It was blonde, and her cheeks were very sunken in. That's what I could picture of her. Now, I remember this moment. I was driving out of the hotel where this course was taught with my father, and I said to my father, "Dad, did you meet your counselor?" And he said, "Yes." And I said, "Who was it? Or what, can you describe her?" And he goes, "Well, it was my third grade teacher." I went, "Really? And can you describe her? I mean, what's she like?" And he goes, "Well, she sort of had blonde, shoulder-length hair, and very sunken in cheeks. Now, I was affected greatly by that moment, and even telling it now, there's a chilling effect of it, because it could not have been coincidence. I had never heard of her, I had never met her, I had never encountered her, and yet he was describing exactly this guy. The reason why I mention that is that it took this event to propel me out of West Hartford life, in the sense of I just could no longer just go along the path and just have a career and just move on in the path that was set out for me. I knew from this that there was some other spiritual realm that existed that I needed to know about, that there actually was something more than just the physical, the temporal, what is seen and touched and felt. This really took me on a trek of a number of years. And interestingly enough, it took some crazy discipline like silver mind control to introduce me to Yeshua, because in that discipline, like so many other disciplines, they grab on a part of him. They say, well, we want it. You can be like him if you do this, if you meditate, if you're in yoga, if you can do transcendental meditation, I can't say it, you will achieve the cosmic consciousness of Jesus the Messiah. Well, needless to say, I knew that there was a way that people found out more about who this Jesus was, and it was in what was known, what I knew then as the New Testament. Well, growing up in a Jewish home, I had no interest in opening up a New Testament. Why would I do that? I have no connection to it. It's for them. I have no interest in it. Yuck. But because of these encounters that I had experienced, I was a little more open to it, like there's something going on here that maybe I need to investigate. Well, that brought me to my college years, and in college I encountered people who professed to have a relationship with Jesus, with who I now know in his Hebrew name Yeshua, and they taught me of him and what the prophets said of him, my own prophets that I didn't even know about. I didn't know the prophetic tradition within my Jewish history that pointed towards the Messiah. It's nothing that was really talked about growing up. It was nothing I was really exposed to. And in that knowledge, I began to realize that which I was looking for was fulfilled in the Messiah, and that I could have a relationship with God and have this sense of another experience of life more than just day to day, because I knew that there was now. I knew there was God. I knew he existed, and I knew that he had a plan for my life. As I've gone over in my mind over the last few days, thinking about tonight, and thinking about what has brought me to this time, I think about the fact that I accepted Messiah at that time during college. And I look now and I say, is it true? Is what you heard and experienced true? The reason why I bring it up is I was telling you that at 50, there's a time in which you assess. It's just something that happens. It's just this point. It's a very concrete stage, and you're just assessing. And I always want to be able to be honest about my life. I want to look at the choices that I've made and say, are they legitimate? Is there evidence for them? Have I made right choices? So someone could say to me, Rob, isn't it obvious to you that you took this path of accepting Yeshua as Messiah, and yet the whole community that you were part of sees you as Meshuggah at best and a threat at worst, or somewhere in between? Now I was thinking, what is it that I can stand on and say, I understand that, but I have evidence to back my faith on. And I just want to spend a couple minutes on that. So what is it that has, as I reflect back on these years, that I can say the choices that I made were good choices, and that the path that I have followed is legitimate? The first thing I look at is the way that God has sustained me in my life. I've gone through many challenges and struggles in my life and have felt God's sustenance in a fantastic way. My first child was 10 weeks premature, and that is a very challenging way to have a first child. She was very ill, and she's extremely healthy today, and I really wish I could have seen a video of her now at 17 when she was born at 3 pounds 2 ounces and went down to 2 pounds 11 ounces. I would have loved to have seen her riding a horse today. Just a 30-second video would have been great. But God sustained me during that time. Other illnesses, other struggles, even including as recent as my son contracting leukemia almost 2 years ago. Jonathan is doing tremendously well today. He only has 3 more months of chemotherapy. But God has sustained me during this time. And I know it because I have felt His presence, I have experienced His comfort, and He has answered my prayers during this time. I can't imagine what it would be like to have gone through this time in my life without my personal relationship with God enabling me and my family during this time. He has been a great source of strength and comfort, and may He be praised. So those are some experiential things. Those are a couple of experiential things. But someone may say, well, look, that's fine. But if Yeshua was the Messiah, isn't there some concrete things that you can point to? Well, there's just a couple that come to mind of many that I want to share with you. Someone could say, if the Messiah came in about the year 30, wouldn't there be evidence of it within Jewish tradition? Wouldn't there be some concrete way of saying some magnificent event has taken place? Well, there is actually evidence. And that I find fascinating, and I challenge you to look at the evidence. The Talmud records a few key events that took place, as the Talmud says, 40 years before the destruction of the temple. The temple, the second temple, was destroyed in the year 70. That actually brings us back to the year 30, which is the year that Yeshua was executed and is purported to have risen, which I do believe. One of the things that's mentioned is that this scarlet thread in the temple, which indicated that the sacrifices were accepted, did not turn white from the year 30 till the end of the destruction of the temple. Now think of this. This is listed in the Talmud, that from the year 30 until the end of the destruction of the temple, the sign that the sacrifices had been accepted no longer was evident. The scarlet thread no longer turned white. By the way, it referred to that scarlet thread turning white was a symbol of the sin being cleansed and the sacrifice being accepted as an atonement. The Talmud says this did not happen for those 40 years. There was a burning light in the western part of the sanctuary of the temple that burned continually, and it was just seen as a sign of God's Shekhinah, His glory, because of this miraculous burning. And that ceased to burn for the last 40 years. And there's another event that's talked about in the Talmud. It's Yoma 98b, and it says that the doors to the Holy of Holies, these huge doors that it took 20 men to close that were bolted down deep and deep below, that these doors opened of their own accord. It was an absolute astounding sight. These are recorded in the Talmud, and they're the kind of things that you would expect to see if the Messiah had indeed come, and if who he said he was real. Those are things that I, at age 50, almost, when I look back, I say, yes, those are concrete things that took place, and you would expect them to have taken place if the Messiah did come, and they actually did happen. I just want to share with you one other thing, that when I make this assessment of the choices that I've made, and I look at them, that has to do with a section of Scripture that I really didn't encounter until later in life. I'm going to read this section to you, and I would say there's a decent chance that many of you have never heard of this passage, and we can try to assess and guess where it's from. I'm going to read to you a section of Scripture, and then we'll discuss it for a moment. Who would believe what we have heard? For whom has the arm of the Lord been revealed? Formerly he grew like a sapling or like a root from arid ground. He had neither form nor grandeur. We saw him, but without such visage that we could desire him. He was despised and isolated from men, a man of pains and accustomed to illness. As one from whom we would hide our faces, he was despised, and we had no regard for him. But in truth, it was our ills that he bore and our pains that he carried. But we had regarded him diseased, stricken by God and afflicted. He was pained because of our rebellious sins and oppressed through our iniquities. The chastisement upon him was for our benefit, and through his wounds we were healed. We have all strayed like sheep, each of us turning his own way, and the Lord inflicted upon him the iniquity of us all. He was persecuted and afflicted, but he did not open his mouth like a sheep being led to the slaughter, or a ewe that is silent before her shearers. He did not open his mouth. Now that he has been released from captivity and judgment, who could have imagined such a generation? For he had been removed from the land of the living, an affliction upon them that was my people's sin. He submitted himself to his grave like wicked men, and the wealthy to his executions, for committing no crime and with no deceit in his mouth. The Lord desired to oppress him, and he afflicted him. If his soul would acknowledge guilt, he would see his offspring and live long days, and the desire of the Lord would succeed in his hand. He would see the purpose and be satisfied with his soul's distress. With his knowledge, my servant will vindicate the righteous one to multitudes. It is their iniquities that he will carry. Therefore, I will assign him a portion from the multitudes, and he will divide the mightiest spoils in return for having poured out his soul for death and being counted among the wicked. For he bore the sin of the multitudes, and he prayed for the wicked. That's from the Hebrew Bible, the 53rd chapter of the prophet Isaiah, 700 years before the coming of the Messiah. I didn't encounter that section once growing up. The reason being, the Bibles that are in the seats in my synagogue and synagogues around the world do not have that section. In the readings of the year, there is the five books of Moses, and then there's connected sections to each of those weekly readings. A lot of the prophets are there, a lot of the writings, but some aren't, and this section is omitted. So I never encountered it. And as I've studied it, and as I've looked at it, I've realized that the choices I made are validated by that. As a matter of fact, one thing that helps me in the assessment of these choices. Someone could say, well, Rob, the rabbis say that that is about Israel. That passage is not about the Messiah. Well, that is pretty much the case over the last few centuries. But for a long time, our rabbis saw this passage as referring to the Messiah. I don't mean that they saw it specifically fulfilled in Yeshua, but they saw it as clearly messianic without any doubt. As a matter of fact, even in the Talmud, referring to the Messiah, it says, the Messiah, this is in Sanhedrin 98, the Messiah, what is his name? The rabbis say, the leper scholar, as it is said, surely he has borne our griefs and carried our sorrows, yet we did esteem him a leper, smitten of God and afflicted. Clear and specific reference to Isaiah 53. Rabbi Moses Alshef in the 16th century, the reason why I'm bringing up some of these are that prior to around 1100, the time of Rashi, there was this unanimity that it pointed to the Messiah. Rashi lived in a time of great persecution of our people. Who can blame him? I don't. For saying, how could this be about the Messiah? These people are killing us in his name. We always thought it was about the Messiah, but we no longer can say it. I don't want to hear his name. I don't blame him. I don't. There was a perverseness. There was a taking of the Jewish Messiah and a perversion of that for centuries against our people. I can't blame him in his wanting to just get away from anything having to do with it. But rabbis later on, such as Rabbi Moses Alshef, said years later, our rabbis with one voice accept and affirm the opinion that the prophet is speaking of the Messiah, and we shall ourselves also adhere to the same view. Another rabbi, Rabbi Elijah Davidas, another well-known rabbi in the 16th century, said, the meaning of he was wounded for our transgressions, bruised for our iniquities, is that since the Messiah bears our iniquities, which produce the effect of his being bruised, it follows that whoever will not admit the Messiah thus suffers for our iniquities must endure and suffer for them himself. Now what's really interesting is a prayer that was in the Yom Kippur books, the Machzorim, the prayer books on Yom Kippur, and I have physically seen it, and I will produce one if you ever really want. Up until around 1920, this prayer was commonly in the Machzor for Yom Kippur. And it was written by Rabbi Eliezer Kalir in the 9th century. Our righteous Messiah has departed from us. Horror has seized us, and we have no one to justify us. He has borne our transgressions and the yoke of our iniquities, and is wounded because of our transgressions. He bore our sins upon his shoulders that we might find pardon for our iniquity. We shall be healed by his wounds at the time when the Eternal will recreate him a new creature. Oh, bring him up from the circle of the earth, raise him from Seir, that we may hear him the second time. For Messianic Jews, to consider that the prophets have spoken of a suffering servant Messiah is something that our people understood for centuries. But because of persecution in his name, it has been hard for us to look at that evidence objectively without pain. And it is a sad story that we have to say that. And yet, we are in a time of restoration when people recognize that period and say, we will be honest with the data, we will encounter it. And for those of us who said this wasn't of the Messiah, we will look at it. And those who may have said, we use this against your people, they are coming to grips with that today. For me, this passage really does say it all. It speaks of the promised Messiah, and I want to end my time with you tonight by chanting for you a portion of it. from the 53rd chapter of Isaiah, verses 4 through 6.
Achen chalayenu nasa umachoveinu svalam va'anachnu chashavnu nagua nu ke'elohim humune. Surely our griefs he himself bore, and our sorrows he carried. Yet we ourselves esteemed him stricken, smitten of God and afflicted. V'hu mecholam ipshayinu meduka me'avonoteinu, musar shlomeinu alav v'chavurato nirpalanu. But he was pierced through for our transgressions, he was crushed for our iniquities. The chastening for our well-being fell upon him, and by his scourging we are healed. Kulanu katzon tahinu ish ladar kopaninu, v'adonai hifkia bo et avon kulanu. All of us like sheep have gone astray. Each of us has turned to his own way. But the Lord has caused the iniquity of us all to fall on him, the sins of us all to fall on him.